The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable John W. Turner presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. We're here on case number 4230165. That's Urso versus Bradley University. Appearing for the appellant is Joel Handler, and appearing for the appellee is William Kohlhaas. Mr. Handler, are you ready to proceed?
I am ready. Is it okay if I sit, or do you want me to stand?
No, you're fine.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. May it please the court. Again, my name is Joel Handler. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Natalie Urso. Your Honors, the judgment, the summary judgment that was entered by the 10th Judicial Circuit on January 25th, 2023 should be reversed. You have a situation here that the parties pretty much agree on the controlling rules of law governing a situation involving a cause of action brought by a student against a private university, in this case Bradley, for breach of contract. Those rules are stated. I'll just briefly cover them. Cover a couple of them with you, and that's one rule being a contract between a private institution and a student confers duties upon both parties, which cannot be arbitrarily disregarded and may be judicially enforced. That's the DeMarco decision that we cited. That's 440 Illap 3rd, 474, 480, 352 Northeast 2nd, 356, 361-362. 1976. Illinois courts have held that that students have a cause of action sounding in breach of contract where the private schools makes an arbitrary and capricious adverse academic decision in the school's treatment of a student, including dismissal. That is the site's Partridge v. Loyola University, Chicago decision. 409 Illap 3rd, 7682, 984 Northeast 2nd, 219, 226, 2007, quoting from the Harris versus Adler decision. To state a claim for breach of contract, a student must point to an identifiable contract promise that the defendant failed to honor, and that's Ross versus Creighton University, 957 Fed 2nd, Fed 10, 410, 416, 417, 7th Circuit, 1992.
Mr. Handler, good morning.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you, but sure. I had a question that goes beyond some of the general legal principles you were just sharing with us.
Sure.
The crux of this case seems to be the definition of an unsafe practice. And that is defined in Bradley's undergraduate nursing handbook. And it also tells us, the handbook also tells us, that whether a student engages in an unsafe practice can affect a student's grade. Would you agree with that, that that's in the handbook?
I would agree that the handbook delineates the three right. situations which would constitute an unsafe practice. None of which is applicable here.
Well, but doesn't Bradley's determination that Urso engaged in an unsafe practice actually constitute an unreviewable academic decision? In other words, this court cannot review academic decisions.
Right, but I'm saying
this is like Frederick. Okay, go ahead.
And it differs from Frederick in the context that you can review this in light of what of the fact situation here. It's not a situation that it was a, you know, strictly, you know, I mean, she was removed from the program, from the nursing
right.
program by virtue of it, okay? But did she engage in that unsafe practice that would, is what you're saying, Judge, would basically, you know, knock her out without an ability to challenge. And I'm saying, no, she does have the right to challenge, because even in an academic standpoint, and the cases hold that, if the decision that the Bradley makes is arbitrary, capricious, and in bad faith, it is subject to a breach of contract action, which included her dismissal from the program.
So how was this arbitrary and capricious?
Well, I will address that right now. First, let's deal with did her conduct namely, she asked the nurse who was on her first day at the hospital there, who took, you know, she was supposed to take the vital signs. No question. Natalie Urso was the one who was supposed to do the vital signs. First day, you have this Holly Phillips there, and Holly Phillips took the vital signs, and Holly Phillips said it was okay for her to put down those vital signs because Natalie came in shortly thereafter. So she puts them down. So was that an unsafe practice? We say it wasn't. It wasn't an unsafe practice. In fact, you know, in looking at the transcript of the hearing, you have an acknowledgement made by the court, the 10th Judicial Circuit, that Bradley didn't follow its procedures here. Clearly didn't follow its procedures. So what I'm saying is, one, it didn't engage, Natalie Urso did not engage in an unsafe practice. One, she didn't pose a threat by putting down those vital signs. It did not pose a threat to that patient. There was no evidence that was elicited about that, Judge. And well, number
two, I'll just interject. You know, the definition includes the potential for a threat.
I'm going to get to that. That's what I was going to get to next, Judge.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead. All right.
And I dealt with that in the reply memorandum that we filed. Okay. So because that was raised by Mr. Kohlhaas. Okay. And first, how does the charting of vital signs 21 minutes after they were taken potentially harm this patient? It didn't at all. Remember that the vital signs merely consist of one's blood pressure, pulse, heart rate, and oxygen level. That's it. That's all it does when Natalie Urso would be taking that. There was no controversy by Bradley that in the room at the hospital, a cardiac patient would be hooked up to various machines. And we're all, you know, cognizant of that, you know, in terms of, you know, what's in a hospital room for a cardiac patient. So there was no evidence introduced by Bradley of any potential harm by virtue of Urso recording these vital signs. There was nothing in the vital signs, Judge, that were taken that indicated that this patient was in some type of distress and therefore it had to be monitored more frequently than what they did. So
are you suggesting, counsel, that we look at this instead of with the definition in the handbook in a real world with real world criteria, and that this court reviews that as opposed to saying, well, the definition is in the handbook. We as a court cannot review academic decisions because the definition was tied to the grade, which was a failing grade, and the university made the decision that she could not continue in the program.
Well, what I'm saying to you is that in reaching a decision, you have to go on what the evidence was, okay, or what the evidence wasn't introduced. Here, there was no evidence whatsoever that this patient was potentially in danger by virtue of the recording of the vital signs. And what you have here, and I understand where you're going, Judge, in terms of, you know, what your question, I'm not trying to beg your question, but what I'm saying to you is that you have to look at everything, and we do have to incorporate our own experiences, are, you know, as well as what the record shows us. So you have a situation where Natalie Urso is being dismissed from this program, being dismissed from the nursing program because of this, of what a nurse told her to do. And there's no controversy on that. It's not being contested by Bradley.
Well, she was dismissed because she had a failing grade.
Well, but here's the thing, Judge. If, would she have gotten the failing grade by virtue of the, if she didn't engage in the conduct? The answer is no. She was passing the course at the time. There was no question on that. She was passing that course. They failed her because they said that you went ahead and you engaged in an unsafe practice. So that's why this is reviewable, Judge. It's just not, you know, it's very, you know, very coy that that Bradley to argue that, oh, well, you can't even consider this appellate court because it's a pure academic decision. No, it is not a pure academic decision. Because so, if Bradley, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead and finish. I apologize.
Okay, because if she did not, or if they determined that, okay, Natalie, don't do it again. If they would have just said, hey, listen, don't do it again, or we're going to suspend you for this period. She wouldn't have failed the course, Judge, at all. She was passing that course. So that's why I'm saying that it's arbitrary, capricious, and in bad faith. And here's another thing with regard to the issue of, you know, you have the 10th Circuit acknowledging clearly, and that's on page of the opinion. It was on page 20 of his opinion where the judge said, there's no dispute that the defendant failed to strictly comply with the letter of its own policies. Okay. And that was dealing in terms of, you know, that we addressed the recording, whether, you know, Natalie, whether the provost was supposed to state his reasons, whether the decision of the two deans was timely made, didn't do it. But then he held, I didn't find that this was done in bad faith. The appellate, the 10th Judicial Circuit does not give us any insight whatsoever as far as why he made that finding. Why is that important? It's important because the cases in Illinois have clearly held if a party to a case has engaged in bad faith, that is a question of fact for a jury to decide. And I can give you three decisions right now that if you want to take them down, that's fine. I just read them off to you right now where they hold this. And they hold it in a myriad of different contexts. One being Swedish American Hospital Association of Rockford versus the Illinois State Medical Interinsurance Exchange, 395 Illab 3rd, 80, 916 Northeast 2nd, 80. It's a 2009 decision. You have the decision in Coffey versus Quinn, same ruling, 578 Fed Sub 1464. It's a Northern District of Illinois decision of 1983. And you also have a case of Schwack, S-C-H-A-W-K, Inc., v. Donruss Trading Cards, 319 Illab 3rd, 640. The Northeast site is 746 Northeast 2nd, 18, 2001 opinion. So you have a situation where this judge went ahead, he found that he concluded that there was bad faith. There was no bad faith. Clearly weighed the evidence, which that it was impermissible here. It's a fact thing, especially in light of the of him finding that we presented evidence that clearly showed that Bradley did not comply with its own handbook and the requirements of its own handbooks and the provisions. So that's why, Judge, when you go in and you look at everything that Bradley did from the beginning, this was a simple situation of a nursing student following the order of a nurse who was there on her first day. And maybe, you know, that was okay for that nurse at a different hospital, you know, the hospital where she previously came from. And she did it and she followed that. But then she is knocked out of the program for doing that at a time when she wasn't failing that course. And therefore, that's why it is reviewable by this court.
Well, she had failed another course a couple years or at some other point prior to that, had the opportunity to make up the failing grade, bring it from a D to a C. So there's only one opportunity to do that. She also was failing the pharmacology course at the same time she was taking the clinical rotation. That's the subject of this case. So there were other factors that I believe were part of the decision.
Well, but that's not
what to allow her. I'm sorry, to continue or not with respect to the program.
Okay, I thought you meant. I meant no, the judge.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
No.
Yes.
Correct.
But there was the testimony that was made that if a, you know, that Bradley did make exceptions if a party was failing two courses at one time in one semester, that would be okay. But you see here, you have a situation where, you know, again, she wasn't failing three, you know, the course in question. And therefore, you know, there's nothing that would prevent Natalie from continuing on in the program.
Well, the type of exceptions that usually are that I believe we found in this case were exceptions for illness or a family situation. None of those seem to be in the record here with respect to the university making exceptions.
Judge, there's nothing in the handbook that says that is limited to those situations at all. And we had the testimony that we got when we took the depositions, and they acknowledged that it wasn't limited to just those situations. So you have a situation where Natalie was proceeding with this course. She was told to do something by the nurse. And the testimony was also, Judge, is that when a nursing student gets an order from a nurse, she is obligated to follow that order. And she did. So now she's being penalized for doing this and gets kicked out of the program. That's why we're saying when you look at all the things and also taking consideration the attitude that Wallenfang and Brubaker had toward her, that it was clear cut that Bradley did engage in conduct that was arbitrary, capricious, and in bad faith. This judge, the 10th Judicial Circuit, had no right to go ahead and take the case away from the jury by saying, okay, I just find that there's no bad faith. Yes, I find that you violated everything, you know, that you didn't follow your procedures, you breached the contract, but I don't find bad faith. I don't see how you can, he shouldn't have made that decision in the first place because it's not within his province. But secondly, because he can't weigh the evidence. Secondly, there is no evidence that there was not bad faith. There was bad faith here.
Well, counsel, I've been listening intently. I've reviewed the briefs, and it seems to me that the administration, and please don't parse my words, but the body to make the decision had a decision to make, and the decision, all the information was taken in, they made a decision. One decision could have been to allow her to continue in the program. However, in most cases, it was for illness and other things. The other decision was termination. I guess what I'm looking for is some type of nexus to say there was some type of capricious act or bad faith. It sounds like what you have is a lack of following the regulations of the handbook, and or some type of proof that the patient was potentially in danger because of this act. So those are the two things. I mean, what do you have? They made a decision. They made a decision, and it's not the decision that they may have made to keep her in with a suspension, but they made a decision. So where's the bad faith?
Bad faith is when you take in consideration the individuals who made the decision, who partook, Judge. You know, you have the first one being Wallenfang because, you know, that's the steps, you know, and both sides in their briefs delineated the steps for you. And so Wallenfang, there's animus, clear animus that she had toward my client. All right. Brubaker also had it. So she comes in, and Wallenfang is the one who made the first decision. You know, it's almost like when, you know, you're like a union employee and you have a, you know, a grievance that you want to bring and, you know, how you go through the various steps. Well, she went through the various steps also. And you have a situation where here it is, the with Wallenfang and Brubaker having this animus toward her.
Well, let me stop you because we won't have so much time. Animus. I mean, we've got these are administrators, professors. There's concern about the academic achievement. How does that rise to the level of animus?
Capricious. When I have someone testifying a deposition, calling my client a liar, all right, and not acknowledging and not requesting, you know, you're as an administrator. You have a person who says, I'm requesting to meet with you to go over things, what have you. You refuse because she brought her mother with her. You refuse the meeting. You know, Judge, there's more to it.
I understand. But the liar, let's just break these down. The liar comment wasn't sort of a generalized, this person is a liar in most contexts. There was a reason for that statement, I believe. And that was something that was stated on email or somewhere that seemed to be incorrect by the administration. Isn't that right?
I think for an administrator to come flat out and make those kind of comments just showed her true colors here in this case. And there was resentment, you know, and that when you read in especially in Wallenfang, she felt that my client had slandered her and, you know, She did not have a very high regard of my client. Okay, and yet
Do you have anything outside of the process of reviewing the situation? Because there's at that point there's confrontation. This is a procedure to basically expel or uphold a decision. So of course there's going to be one's positions stated and you know, this isn't as though these statements were made while she was merely a student and there weren't these adversarial proceedings going on. Do you have anything prior to the adversarial proceedings that would suggest?
Well, I think that this was before, I think we did when we cited in our brief that there were problems that she had with that Natalie had with Brubaker and Wallenfang before.
And was that associated with the first failure?
No, it was not associated with the first failure, but it was just in terms of dealing with them. In fact, when Natalie first made a request for Wallenfang to meet with her, she pulled out. She canceled the meeting. And that's when Wallenfang nevertheless said, no, we're going forward with this meeting. And that's when she was told, you're out. Okay. So I think that there is more that, you know, that this attitude that Wallenfang Brubaker had toward Natalie existed well before this incident occurred.
Mr. Handler, you are past your allotted time, so you will have rebuttal. Mr. Polkowitz, would you proceed with your argument now?
Thank you. May it please the court. The real question, as the court has focused on, is not whether there was a correct decision, but was there an academic decision made by the institution? In this situation, in the practicum course at the hospital, an unsatisfactory grade was awarded based on what the instructor determined was unsafe practice. I'm not going to go through the details of the record. They're in our brief very clearly, but what you have is an admission that the plaintiff entered vital signs in the electronic medical record, reflecting them being taken at a time when they were not actually taken. The instructor determined that under the standards of the Bradley University Nursing Department, that was an unsafe practice. That's the initial academic decision. That decision was then reviewed by the department chair and upheld after the department chair pointed out that the plaintiff had received instruction in prior courses regarding charting, what's to be put in the chart, and what's not to be put into the chart, the need for you to actually do the work yourself. That was then reviewed by the dean, and the dean upheld that decision. Then it went to the student grievance committee, which determined that what happened was consistent with prior determinations in the nursing department, and that while they were sympathetic to the plaintiff, the grade had to be upheld. They realized the negative consequences, but as has been pointed out, those negative consequences resulted from other academic performance. It was not a decision that you engage in unsafe practice, therefore you cannot continue in the nursing program. It was a decision that what you did in charting vitals that you didn't take at a time when they were not taken was an unsafe practice, therefore your grade is going to be unsatisfactory. It could have been a different outcome, but that's a discretionary call. And counsel, the result
excuse me for interrupting you. It's hard, obviously, when we're on video to find the right moment. So I apologize for interrupting in the middle of a sentence. But opposing counsel seemed to indicate that that this court should be looking at, quote, the facts of this case, not necessarily the definition, or to see if they met the definition in the handbook, or possibly suggesting that maybe in a real hospital setting, this might not have been an unsafe practice. So is that the role of this court in reviewing the trial court's decision with regard to the summary judgment motions?
No, not at all. The role of the court in this context, as many, many decisions have indicated, is to determine, was there in fact an academic decision made? If there was, it should be deferred to, period. That's the law.
And how was this an academic decision?
Because once the student did what she did, there's a question. Okay, was that an unsafe practice to chart something that you didn't read, you didn't take those vitals, and you put them in the electronic medical record at the hospital for a live patient at a time other than when those vitals were taken? Is that unsafe? That's a judgment for nursing faculty. That's not a legal judgment, Your Honor.
And this was certainly not, however, it wasn't an academic course per se, it was a clinical course, but a course nevertheless.
Yes, absolutely it was. It was a required course. And in addition, to jump ahead a little bit, as you pointed out, in the pharmacology course, NUR 318, the plaintiff also got less than a C. That was another required course with an exam, and that also would bar her from continuing as a nursing major. She wasn't expelled from Bradley. She just could not continue as a nursing major. Certainly that was her desire, but the academic standards of the program have to be met in order to stay in the program. She didn't meet the standards. That's why she was not allowed to continue, period.
But opposing counsel also pointed out that the university chose not to afford her the exceptional circumstances or to make an exception for her, as they did perhaps for other students. How do we look at that?
Number one, she never requested an exception. Number two, the exception is not something that is a formal part of the nursing department student handbook. It's something that the faculty have done, as the testimony showed, over the years, based on a vote of all the faculty in the department, based on the circumstances of a particular student in the same semester, under circumstances, as the court has pointed out, where the student had a family emergency, there was an illness, there was something like that. There's nothing in the record to support the application of any exception here, starting with the fact that no exception was requested.
In the review process by the various deans and committees, the timelines in the handbook weren't always adhered to. Does that render the actions of the university arbitrary and capricious?
No, the Illinois law is clear on the point that if there's a procedural misstep by the institution in connection with a process as occurred here, that does not per se render a decision arbitrary and capricious, period. It's, you look at the whole picture, was it a decision, as has been pointed out, again, there was a process, the process was followed. I understand the procedural quibbles, and I don't want to spend time on that here. They're minor at best, and we dispute those, but it really doesn't matter because the law is clear that that by itself does not create an arbitrary and capricious decision. The real bottom line issue is, was there an academic judgment made? That is what happened here, based on the standards that the faculty apply as experts in nursing education. That's what happened here.
And opposing counsel mentioned at the very end of his argument the point that there appeared to be animus on the part of the faculty towards Ms. Urso, and that affected their decision and contributed to it being arbitrary and capricious. Do you want to speak to the animus that apparently is reflected in some of the deposition testimony that was submitted to the court as part of the motion for summary judgment?
We dispute that there is any pre-dispute animus reflected in the record. There's nothing unrelated to the academic decision at issue here. There was a lot of emotion once this happened, and the plaintiff and her family were very firm in their resolve that she should not be excluded from the program, should not have gotten an unsatisfactory grade. There was some emotion after that, but there was no pre-academic decision animus, period. It's not in the record anywhere. That's our position, and the record supports it.
Thank you.
So, in terms of the basic proposition here, I think that the argument that Bradley was wrong really demonstrates that there was a decision and therefore it should be deferred to. With respect to, this is a sort of a minor point, but I want to add it anyway. With respect to these procedural glitches that they perceive and that we dispute, there isn't any indication anywhere in anything that the plaintiff ever filed that the dean if they were 3 days late because the parent and child met with both the faculty department chair and the dean on the same day, and they both have a timeline going forward. They argue there should have been a transcript of the grievance committee hearing. They can't point to anything that requires that. They say, well, there's nothing that says you can't do it. And then they complain about the provost not articulating his reasons for agreeing with the grievance committee. There is nothing that the plaintiff advances to the effect that any of those, if they were glitches, that somehow she was damaged. Was the dean being 3 days late the cause of a different outcome? You can ask the same thing about the transcript or what the provost did. There's just nothing in the record to support, if those were breaches, which we dispute, that there was any resulting damage, and therefore there is no breach of contract claim that can be based on those. But to return to the proper focus, this was an academic decision. The court should defer to it. That's our argument. Be happy to answer more questions. Otherwise, I'm finished.
Mr. Kohlhaas, I have one question. It appears that Deborah Daniels, in her deposition, thought that the entry was made 40 minutes after the vitals were taken rather than 21. Does that make any difference?
No. No. The vitals, the record supports the understanding of the nursing faculty that vitals can change at any time. So whether it's 20 minutes or 40 minutes, it doesn't matter. It was an entry in the record that was not accurate, period.
If the plaintiff had entered the vitals at 10:16, it had indicated that they had actually been taken at 9:55 a.m. and that they were taken by a different nurse, or the registered nurse, would we be here today?
I can only speculate and say perhaps not, because the record would have been clear. And this is an electronic record in a system at a hospital. This is like everybody's relying on this record. And so if it had been different and the instructor had seen that there was a paper trail, but, electronic trail that said, okay, this is what I'm doing, and explain what it was, so anyone looking at it would not say, oh, here's what happened at 10:55 or 10:16 or whatever. That may well have led the instructor to reach a different conclusion, but that, of course, is not what happened.
Okay, I don't see any other questions. Mr. Handler, do you have any rebuttal?
I do. Thank you, Judge.
Sure.
First, with regard that Mr. Kohlhaas is mentioning about a pure academic decision, I again refer the court to the Zeitz v. Partridge decision, which Mr. Kohlhaas does cite in his brief, where for the rule of law that holds that Illinois courts have held that students have a cause of action sounding in breach of contract where a private school makes a arbitrary and capricious adverse academic decision in the school's treatment of a student, including dismissal of the student. And so that Zeitz v. Partridge versus Loyola, 409 Illap 3rd, 7682, 984 Northeast 2nd, 219, 226, 2007. This is an adverse academic decision that was made here. So it's not a situation that, Mr. Coley is giving the proposition, oh, well, because it's an academic decision, you just have to, you can't touch it. You can't touch it. No, that's not what the Zeitz case said, which he recited in his own brief. You have, the thing about being arbitrary and capricious here, and about these various things, these steps that we were talking about. One, the Bradley in the summary judgment briefing did not contest that these steps were not followed. They did in the argument section, but not in terms of the statement of facts. In fact, Mr. Kohlhase filed a response admitting to the deposition testimony that I cited in support of our motion for summary judgment. You have a situation that these steps had to be followed. If they didn't have to be followed, why were they placed in the handbook? Why were they placed in the handbook? So, I mean, they can go ahead and disregard, and this is what, you know, you see. The educational institution says, student, you have to follow these rules, but we don't have to follow them? That's not what the testimony was. Judge, I'll be with you in 1 second. I'm sorry. Okay, I apologize. All the individuals that I deposed from Bradley said that they had to follow those rules. All right. And therefore, they can't go ahead now and say, well, it was minor or what have you. It wasn't minor. If it was so minor, why did you have this, you know, four-step process that my client had to follow? It wasn't minor. She followed it to a T. They didn't follow it to the T. The circuit court acknowledged that they didn't follow it. So the thing is, and this gets back to Judge Zenoff's claim about, you know, and, you know, what we discussed earlier on, was that bad faith? It was bad faith when you can take in consideration all the facts that went on here. When you have a provost.
But counsel, these were recommended guidelines, correct? So that means that.
No, Judge, they said that, they all said that they were mandatory.
That the timelines?
They said that they had to follow.
In the student grievance procedure?
They had to follow.
Well, I'll take another look then at the.
No, I really, I hope
looked at them as. Saw them as recommended guidelines.
They weren't recommendations, Judge. They were mandatory. They were mandatory.
Responding to opposing counsel's point, how was your client prejudiced by, let's say, the 3-day late decision?
Oh, when you look at it in mass, what happened to her? She got kicked out of the program, right? She was unable for 2 years to become, you know, she was in her graduating year. She was unable to be a nurse for 2 years by virtue of this. She had no, she couldn't go forward. Here's the thing. You have this process. The process is not followed. You're then told you're out of the program. You can stay and be a Bradley student if you want, but you're out. You can't be a nurse. So she pays tuition and for the nursing program and is out of that program. So she's out all the money that she paid to become what she wanted to be for her life profession. So because there wasn't adherence to, first of all, there wasn't an unsafe practice. Okay. So therefore, this should never have even happened. So she has been, when you take it all together, Judge, and you look at this, one, she didn't engage in an unsafe practice. Two, the steps that they followed weren't followed, which were mandatory to be followed. She's damaged because the end result is that she is deprived of her profession.
Justice,
so that's how she is.
Has Mr. Handler answered your question?
Yes.
Okay, that being the case, Mr. Handler, you are out of time. We thank both of you for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will stand in recess until 11 a.m.